Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we are seeking solutions. That, of course, was Dr. Feelgood, Back in the Night. That's what I call R&B. They seem to have changed the meaning of it nowadays. Before that, Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths. All talk, let sound without meaning wash right over me. Fair way of approaching it. And before that, the third incarnation of Deep Purple playing the single edit of Burn. Well, tonight on the show, I should be joined by Karma Singh, who's hopefully going to bring us up to date on the interesting project we covered several weeks back now, where people have apparently successfully established a kingdom in Germany. There's been a lot of stuff going on. There's a few questions outstanding from last time I spoke to him on the subject, specifically to do with the money and how it's created, which I hope to get into a bit tonight. And later on in the show, we'll be talking about Karma's more typical interest, which is actually alternative and complementary health. And he has a fair old crack on his various websites and in his books at Allopathic Medicine. So I'm going to put on one more tune whilst I phone Karma up, having checked that everything's working, which it seems to be. Great to see so many of you in the chat box. Really brilliant. So I'm going to play Eddie and the Hot Rods, Ignore Them. I think it was the B-side of one of their singles. I think it's one of their best tunes myself. Great lyric. There you go, Eddie and the Hot Rods there, and Ignore Them. Another probably pretty sound piece of advice, I'd say. And as you can hear, I'm now joined live on the line by Karma Singh. Thanks very much for joining us again, Karma.
My pleasure, thank you.
And you've been a busy chap since we talked to you last. I know there was a meeting coming up on the Kingdom of Germany shortly after that, but you've been active over the last 3 days. Can you just give us a quick summary of what's going on there for people who didn't hear the earlier show and any new listeners?
Well, a lot has happened since the earlier show. What's actually going on, there has been about 4 years, constant toing and froing between the kingdom and the Königliche Reichsbank, which is supposed to be the Royal State Bank of the Kingdom of Germany, as to, you know, how can this bank be run in a manner which actually simultaneously conforms to the rules of the Federal Republic of Germany. I say very explicitly rules, not laws, because there are no laws where there is no state, but the rules. And the body which is responsible for overseeing the rules in the Federal Republic of Germany is called the BaFin, the Bundesanstalt für Finanzdienstleistungen oder Wertpapierwesen. It's one of those very long words.
That is a long one.
That's the short version. Anyway, it's called BaFin. It has sort of general similarities to the Financial Services Agency, which is well known in the UK, and also to the Exchange Control Commission in the US of A, which actually functions in a way very, very similar to the BaFin. Now, the BaFin is, from legislation, a government department, but that's where the government interest and the public interest ends, because it's actually financed and controlled by the major banks, and the personnel are appointed by the major banks.
Okay, so, and this is the organisation that is responsible for regulating the banks as well.
It was set up to regulate the entire financial industry, including banks and insurance, and it's actually paid, financed and controlled 100% by the banks.
So we encounter the usual blatant conflicts of interest then.
Yeah. Anyway, as I say, there's been this toing and froing, and agreements have been reached at every point where they say, okay, well, we'll change the terms and conditions for the Royal State Bank, the Königliche Reichsbank, so that it doesn't interfere with your own internal rules. And in, I think it was October, or it might have been September, where they actually reached the final point where the BaFin were in a state where they would have to make a declaration that they have no responsibility, they have no authority over the Königliche Reichsbank. which, of course, would be a very, very nice thing to hear in the public world. Now, unfortunately, their bosses decided, well, no, we can't actually allow this. We can't allow an independent, honest bank. That, you know, no, no, definitely not. So, the BaFin were giving instructions to do something which I'd not actually come across myself in Europe before. I've come across it a couple of times in America. I'll just give you this as a as an example. About 4 or 5 years ago, a few friends in Canada and America were trying to persuade me to join in with a highly successful trading company. Trading products, not promises. And I thought, oh no, I got a funny feeling. And I said, no, I'll hold back. Anyway, this company just went from success to success to success. And they weren't borrowing any money from the banks. And they weren't, you know, giving the banks much, much of anything at all. And so what the banks did, they sent in the Exchange Control Commission, who discovered a very outdated minor law in Georgia, although this company was actually in Illinois, if I remember correctly, but it was, you know, it was a long way away. It wasn't actually in Georgia. And they used this as an excuse to put in to put the entire company into receivership to protect the interests of the customers and investors. And of course the official receiver charging $35,000 per hour he broke up the company, sold all the assets, and almost all of it went into his pocket, and the investors and customers ended up with about just under 3 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, again, seems to be a pretty standard fraud nowadays, that one does. There's a lot of it going on in the UK as well, as far as I can gather.
Ah, okay. Anyway, the BaFin work in quite a similar way. When they pick a victim, and, you know, the Koenigreicher Rice Bank isn't the first victim. And they confiscate everything. They confiscate the bank accounts. They confiscate the private bank accounts of the employees. Wow. So that... working on the assumption that, you know, if nobody's got any money, they're not going to be able to pay any lawyers to correct the situation. And what they actually did was they went to the local county court in Wittenberg and applied for an order to march into the premises and look for evidence in terms of data and documents, which would indicate that an illegal bank was being operated.
Excuse me, do they not recognise irony? You know,
yeah.
I mean, talk about illegal banks.
Yeah, anyway, this was the excuse. So this they had a court authority to look for evidence that an illegal bank was being run. What they then actually did, employed I don't know what sort of company it is, but they're from Poland. Anyway, there was a fleet of lorries turned up from Poland, and they took away anything and everything that they could move. I mean, they had authority to look for documents and electronic data. They took a crane. They took a lathe, which weighs 3.5 tons. They took a 20-ton crane, a 3.5-ton lathe, you know. They took away the entire kitchen for the central kitchen for the I don't know what you call it now. There's a large complex where lots of things go on, and they took the entire kitchen. They took all foodstuffs. They broke into the apartments of the people who were working there and stole anything of value that they could lay their hands on.
Well, really?
No list of what was taken has ever been handed over, and that in itself is a crime. The lathe, we know, was sold to a different company a couple of miles down the road for way below the scrap value. A few days later, the kitchen was found hammered to uselessness at a scrap metal dealer's. But most of the stuff that was taken was just disappeared on lorries into Poland.
That's astonishing. That must have come as a real surprise to the people at the bank.
No.
It didn't.
No, it was obvious that the BaFin were either going to have to recognize that this is a real bank, which anybody can use, or they were going to have to try to destroy everything. Mm-hmm. And this is what they set out to do. They set out to it's a terror attack, to intimidate everybody working there, to try and put them in a state where they can't defend themselves because they have no money. And it didn't work.
Of course, Wittenberg is where you've got one of your functional centres, isn't it? Where you're running a bit of a tax-free state, and that's where your main bank is. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's where they broke into. They broke into all three of the premises, they've done. A few days later, most amazing thing. The BaFin said, right, we've successfully robbed this bank, therefore the bank's domain names belong to us. Anyway, what the BaFin relied upon was the assumption that nobody would challenge what they did, which usually is the case. Their activities are not challenged. There was one case a few years ago where somebody did fight, and after 3 years, the BaFin gave up. But we're doing it much faster than that. Mm. We won the first two court cases, the really good one today. One of the major points that the BaFin was saying is that there has been an illegal health insurance company being operated, which has generated €462,000 of cash. Therefore, we must, to protect the insured, we must confiscate this money. Mm-hmm. The court said today, we have examined all of the insurance contracts, only one of which has a minor infringement of the BaFin rules, and we set the fine for this infringement at €4,200 to be paid within the next 12 months to a charity of your choice, which means that the BaFin have to give back every other penny that they've taken.
That's pretty good, isn't it? What sort of court was it that actually stood up to this financial regulator?
This was a local county court. Now, here's the thing. With that ruling, and there's no way the BaFin can challenge it because it's given according to their own rules. Once we've got that in writing, we then go to, a court that a part of the German court system doesn't have a direct English parallel. It's a bit like the Court of Chancery. It's about the nearest you can get to it. Mm-hmm. And we go with that ruling and apply for a court order for the BaFin to terminate all their activities and to surrender everything they've taken, which is bloody difficult because most of it they've either sold to this Polish transport company or have destroyed. So then we come to a damages claim plus, the moral, mental torment on this. And I'm looking at 20 million damages.
It's a pretty astonishingly blatant thing for a nominal arm of government to have done, isn't it? Is it making any kind of waves in the criminal mainstream media, or is it all still very much under the counter?
It's not being mentioned at all in the major press. If the BaFin had won today, it would be, but they didn't. They lost, so it wasn't mentioned. Mm.
And they've effectively set a precedent by making that judgment in the county court.
Yeah, yeah.
So when did this hit on the bank occur?
The 27th to the 29th of November.
Okay, and you've had two court cases since then?
Yeah.
Okay, and what did the court have to say about the specific case of the bank today?
Well, all that they ruled on today was the insurance health insurance, which was the main theme of the BaFin accusations, and the bank was very much a secondary affair. They thought they had us over the barrel with the insurance, but they didn't. And the court decided with us as well.
Very good. So what's going to happen next, do you reckon?
Well, next, as soon as we got this judgment in writing, we then go to this, Verwaltungsgericht, which is...
Your chancery equivalent, broadly.
Yeah, it's about as close as you can get to it. There is no direct equivalent. Yeah. And this is the court which has the power of authority over what any and every bureaucrat does, and even over government. They have the power to tell government, stop doing that, it is illegal.
Have they got a track record of actually doing that?
They have indeed. We've also got the situation in Germany, which exists all over the world. I mean, you see it with federal judge, what's his name? Napolitano in USA. He's a federal judge, and he's kicking the, Congress, in the, ghoulies. Mm-hmm. And what we have here is, in Germany, we have a very high percentage of judges. They have, they've had it up to the eyeballs with the corruption in this system. And given them half a chance to kick them in the ghoulies, they go in with both boots. And that's what happened today.
Brilliant. We got a request from Freeman Jack in the chat box asking if you could just repeat your description of the precedent that's been set and maybe elaborate on it a little.
It's not really a precedent. What normally happens is that when BaFin does something like this, the people that they've attacked are so demoralized and have such difficulty getting any money together to even eat, let alone pay for lawyers, that they just don't make any attempt to get legal restitution. And they picked a wrong one here.
Okay, the basic flaw in their argument was to do with health insurance.
They were saying that the health insurance that we offer is in some manner illegal, which they didn't actually explain in the initial complaint in what manner it's illegal. Then they're saying because the money goes into the Königliche Reichsbank, in order to protect the interests of the investors and the insureds, we must wind up the bank, we must confiscate all the money, etc., etc.
Okay, so they emptied the bank on the basis of a claim which they didn't support, that the health insurance was in some sense not legitimate. And they'd done this to somebody else before, is that correct?
What the other example was, I don't know. It was just mentioned to me in passing the last time I was there that there's only ever been one case where somebody did manage to get the wherewithal together to challenge the BaFin's actions in the court, and of course won.
Okay. Right. So
Are
you going to be looking into that? You're going to be looking into that a bit further to find out what happened there?
No, not interested at all. They're only interested in what's going to happen in the court with our cases.
Mm. So that's basically now in your court, as it were, isn't it? If you'll excuse the pun.
We are fighting our battles. We are intending to win our case, and we cannot see that there is any legal way that the BaFin can win anything at all. All their accusations are provably untrue. And then their actions are literally criminal. The fencing, selling stolen goods.
Yeah.
Criminal damage, depriving people of their freedom without an arrest warrant and without charge, etc. There's a lot of highly illegal stuff.
And one of the things about the Kingdom of Germany is that it has to stay within the rules of the GDR, doesn't it? So presumably that must apply to the BaFin as well.
Yeah. Well, the BaFin, as with the Federal Trade Commission, says, the law that we administer doesn't actually apply to us.
Yeah.
And usually they get away with it because they bring people into a state where they literally haven't even got a shirt on the back. I mean, what they did to when they left, there was nothing to eat. They took the phones, they took the furniture. You know, they had authority to look for documents, and they're taking, you know, 3-piece suites and dining tables and cutlery.
It is really astonishing. I mean, we are seeing quite a lot of fairly blatant activity nowadays, but, you know, I keep hearing things on this show that leave me just lost for words, and this is definitely one of those occasions. So what about the bank and the people with the accounts and all of your Engels and all that sort of stuff? Because are you still managing, is the kingdom still managing to function having had this occur to it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was not unexpected. As I say, the only two things could happen. One was that the BaFin would officially recognize that this is a legitimate bank of a different kind. And the other one was that they would use any force that they could muster to try and destroy it before it could spread. And the effect is that we expect to have the bank fully operational again by February at the latest. We then push forward with getting the local parishes to transfer from the Federal Republic to the Kingdom. And there are just a tremendously long list of advantages for doing so, and no disadvantages. And as the local communes, the parishes are being squeezed more and more and more by the voraciousness of the banks, of course, acting through the so-called Federal Republic of Germany government, that a great percentage of the politicians are in favor of the change. They just need it in an ordinary manner and to be certain that they can set it through. And this is what's happening. You see, the BaFin has now done the very worst that they possibly could and are losing.
Yeah, yes. And I would imagine that, you know, with given a couple of shrewd interviews and a proper write-up of this, it's possibly going to make it a bit easier to get people to come over to your side.
It has already. When this blew up, I started getting emails asking me, well, what's going on? Why is the Kingdom of Germany website offline? And my rate of growth of my mailing list, which has been pretty stagnant for most of the year, is now climbing between 60 and 80 per week since that happened.
Very good. It strikes me as a project which definitely should be attracting quite, because one of the, I think that one of the challenges we face over in our neck of the woods is the fact that whilst more and more and more people are wakening up to what's actually going on, there isn't as yet anywhere else to go. There isn't another system as far as I can see that is taking a bat to the government, for example, or indeed to the financial regulators who are not only operating with more or less complete impunity, but it seems that most of the high-up individuals that were responsible for, you know, the most recent banking collapse and the government having to take over banks and all that sort of stuff are actually now in positions where they're responsible for financial and fiscal probity actually in the government. So yeah. far from being attacked, they're actually being promoted and knighted and all the rest of it. So I find it quite interesting actually that Germany's got the facility to do this for the people and that they are actually enacting it. I find that quite exciting news.
Well, there are lots of prophecies which actually say that Germany will be the first major country to leave the system. The first country, of course, is Iceland, and they're doing very nicely, thank you very much. And, you know, it looks as though Germany is set up to be the first big one, and it could even be this year.
Do you still have a strong and productive economy of any sort over there? Is Germany still turning out actual physical things that people can buy?
Yes. Not as much as they used to, but yes. But that's not the way the Kingdom of Germany economy is designed to run.
So what's the basis of the new economy? Because we want to get onto a bit about how it's going to create its money, but perhaps describing the economy and the basis of the economy a little bit would be a good idea first.
Okay, we're not about creating money, we're about creating wealth. There's a difference. Money is a symbolic representation of wealth. And if you create money over and above the wealth behind it, it becomes a fiat currency which causes hyperinflation and eventual collapse. If you create wealth, that's something very different. Right throughout the First World, we have a situation where most people are working for two, because partially because government action, partly because of the banking cartel, it's become so expensive to employ people that it's just not viable to pay one man one job. It's got to be one man two jobs.
Yeah.
That's the only way it's viable. Now, this works out because if you add together everything that's deducted from your gross pay, everything added together, including the tax on everything that you buy, 81% of your income disappears in tax and interest.
Yeah, so you're basically working 4 days for somebody else and then one day for yourself if you're lucky.
Yeah, I mean, put it this way around. Most of tax goes to the banks to pay interest on phantom loans. I don't know the figures for the UK. In Germany, because the Federal Republic is very inefficient, from the tax money collected, 11.7% is actually used for the people.
Yeah, and the rest of it goes for paying the debt or helping out in dodgy foreign wars, I'll bet.
Well, the bulk of it goes to paying interest on loans of money which has never existed. In enormous administrative structures to designed to steal money from citizens, called the Inland Revenue or Finanzamt in Germany. Structures to designed to prevent people getting out of poverty. And a tremendous amount of money wasted on so-called social projects to, set aside a lot of the damage caused by the banking cartel. But if you eliminate the banking cartel, if you eliminate interest, and if you eliminate tax, suddenly people's gross income is also their net income.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if your income suddenly goes up five times without doing anything extra for it, if your disposable income, goes up five times without doing anything extra for it, are you going to keep working for two?
Mm. And yeah. Most of what the state is spending its money on is either unnecessary or fraudulent.
Exactly.
Yeah, because that's there were a couple of discussions going on in the chat room after we spoke last time, and one of them was to do with, it's a question I was asked recently by somebody who was listening to the podcast. They said, it's all very well, but if people aren't paying tax, how do you get the bins emptied? And so let's have a go at that one. Let's just assume for the moment that paying tax is what's responsible for emptying the bins and not get into that one. But perhaps you could explain how it is that the state functions if it's not charging, the 8 out of 10 pennies that are being charged here at the moment.
Okay, well, the people who know about these things, and have looked at it in detail, have said that the amount of money necessary to run an efficient society is 7.6%, not 76, 7.6% of the money presently taken in as taxes. And it may well be that taxes is not the most efficient way of gaining this money, which it isn't. It's a very inefficient way of doing it.
It's certainly extremely bureaucratic and stuff here. Very, very complicated. I'm sure it could be a lot easier than it is.
Yeah. Okay, well, so we've abolished taxation in the kingdom. So where does the money come from needed to operate, as you say, to empty the bins? Well, you could actually have a look at what happens to the money at the moment. Okay, you as a householder pay this money to some company, probably sounds sort of highfalutin, even environmental protection, yellow or whatever. You pay them to take your rubbish away. They then give it back to you in another form by burning it or whatever. The point is this, that the greater part of the money that they collect doesn't get used for disposing of rubbish. It gets paid out to shareholders and directors' pockets and stuff like that. And which is why rubbish collection and a lot of what used to be considered local amenities have been put into private hands, because the banking cartel, this isn't a nice way of making even more money from the people. Mm-hmm. So things like that then get put back into the hands of the local authorities where they belong. And we have wonderful little things like, there was one, small town in Bavaria. This goes back about 3 years, I think. And, they built their own water sewage recycling system based upon natural fermentation processes. And it went through a series of lakes, small lakes, and you start with raw sewage at one end, and in the fifth lake, I think, you get drinking water. And, you know, so they weren't paying any of the big water companies either to process their sewage or to deliver drinking water. So they were, the town was invaded by, a small town was invaded by a large body of armed police, and the recycling facilities destroyed.
Blimey.
Yeah. And, but on the other hand, this is exactly the sort of thing that the kingdom encourages, this self-sufficiency, this natural recycling, which costs nothing and quite often can actually make a profit. You just need to go at it in a different way. We just need to come look at the way things work in nature instead of trying to make a fast buck by thwarting nature.
Yeah. Yeah, there are, this is one of the things I think that is so optimistic about the situation that we're in, is we do have many simple and natural solutions to things that are currently neither simple nor natural nor actually solutions.
Yeah.
I mean, that business where your small Bavarian community went to the trouble of, presumably financing and building and supervising and running this kind of, this effluent system. I can't think of a better way of bringing to their attention what's going on than to have government forces come and take it all apart and confiscate it and generally trash it.
Yeah, that happened there and then. We were not in a position to do anything about it then. But it is exactly the sort of thing that we would encourage the communes to do. You know, what is rubbish? I mean, the bulk of it is created unnecessarily anyway. It's a lot of rubbish is created by legislation.
Yes, yes.
But a lot of it is quite high valuable stuff if you handle it right. A great part of it can be turned into good compost, which can be used on the local fields. Okay, some can't, but you don't need this enormous rubbish dump that we got at the moment. You can look at it in a different way. You can educate people in a different way, and it works much, much easier with a small community than it does with, you know, let me give you an example, the Greater London Council. You know, it's just too big. And because it's so big, it can't reach the people. Which means that even if the GLC decided, okay, we are going in for recycling in a very big way, they're not in a position to talk directly to the people on the spot and say, okay, what we want to do is this sort of rubbish here, this sort of rubbish here, and please don't mess it up. But if you're in a local community where the guy who's organizing this is the guy who lives next door to your sister, you know, then you've got a community action. The people look at what's going on. Now, here is a world leader from the UK, Todmorden, the edible town.
Yeah.
That's coming on really, really strongly in Germany and Holland. There are a growing number of small towns are starting it up. But again, it's this community-based way of doing things. There's a brilliant book, actually, which you can download from this website, ubuntu.com, but if it isn't, just Google Ubuntu and then you can download his book. And Ubuntu is the perfect complement to the Kingdom of Germany.
This is Michael Tellinger's project, isn't it?
Yeah,
that is ubuntu.com. What's the book called?
It's simply called Ubuntu, but it's on the first page of his website in the left-hand column. You can't miss it.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, Ubuntu is a detailed description of how the communities can organize themselves so that it actually costs nothing to run them, literally nothing. And the kingdom is the umbrella organization that acts as a coordinator between the communities. So this is the perfect complement. This is what we've got here.
Does that give you the ability to say take something successful like the Bavarian experiment and make it available to other people without them having to learn all of the lessons that were learned by the pioneers?
Yeah. I mean, that is just one example, but there are masses and masses and masses of such things which are simply not allowed because the profits of some big corporation are in the way.
Mm. And the only way of really effectively chipping away at that is to come up with simple, effective solutions that we can deal with, create and manage ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
Did the guys in Bavaria rebuild their sewage system?
No. The lady mayoress spent some time in prison for daring to damage the profits of the local water company. Wasn't the actual official charge, but it was. That's what it was actually about. And so far as I know, it was never rebuilt, but it wasn't even new then. She got the idea, same place I first heard of it, from an article in Time magazine of a pilot project, I think in Texas, sometime in the 1980s. I couldn't tell you exactly when now. And there are so many things like, do you know how many free energy machines there are on the planet at the moment?
I've certainly read an awful lot about them and had some interesting discussions this weekend and looked at the plan for one and things like that. It seems there's plenty of them out there. It seems to me that the world management team are sort of sanguine about you developing them, but if you try to take them to market, they'll probably have you shot.
Well, no, the situation is very different. There are more than 100 million active free energy machines on the planet.
How do we know that? Just as a matter of interest?
Well, read Michael Tellinger's book. You will see where he gets this. What's
okay.
missing? This is all ancient technology. Most of it is more than 200,000 years old, and they still work. The bit that we've lost is the technology to convert this energy into electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
That's the bit that we need.
Yeah, I remember hearing about a guy who built himself a scale model of the Great Pyramid and realized in a dream or something. I think he's on YouTube. He realized that it was a generator and a masser of energy, and he concluded that it needed a kind of copper terminal at the top and the bottom. And he got himself up on a ladder and hung a piece of wool from his top connection, and it didn't quite reach the bottom connection on the floor, but nonetheless, apparently, when he went up to try and touch the piece of wool, it just threw him against the wall of the pyramid.
Aha. Uh-huh. Yep.
So I don't find any of this very difficult to believe. And that's not to mention the quite considerable amount of work that's gone into using things like acetate discs and friction-free bearings and stuff for making, generators in the modern age. And this is really what's keeping the slaves, isn't it? Is being addicted to expensive energy systems where every single bit of it you use costs you an arm and a leg. If we could sort that one out, then presumably everything else would become a lot easier.
Well, yeah, that it's certainly something that will be very heavily promoted in the kingdom, free energy. We have some designs which have been given us, which we are planning to build and to market to citizens of the kingdom. We're not allowed to market them to people who are not citizens at the moment, but anybody who lives in an area which has changed its nationality to that of the kingdom, anybody who actually lives there can have them. Mm. The thing is this, when you reduce the working week to 20 to 25 hours, which, if you give people five times the disposable income that they have now, that's going to happen. That's a normal working week in the kingdom is 20 to 25 hours. That means no more doing two jobs just to get the money for, well, less than the money for one. But we then immediately go into full employment, which means, of course, an economic boom, which means that there's suddenly a market for the little things that people make in their sheds and garages and whatnot. And what we're looking at is a revival of the small business, the entrepreneur, where we don't want these great conglomerates. We want the small entrepreneur who makes things that to a very high quality that people need.
And he'll, of course, have the time to do that sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, if you're working 20, 25 hours a week and your place of work is within a few hundred yards of where you live, so you walk to work. One of the effects of this is that of the kingdom is that we would actually need 40% less road surface than is being used now.
When you
dig into it, you come up with these fascinating things, because people no longer have to travel enormous distances just to find work to get the money to live. Because the overproduction, which just ends up in the rubbish dumps, is no longer happening, the reduction in the number of vehicles on the road equates to about 40% less road surface with the same traffic concentration we have at the moment.
Yeah, well, we'd certainly drive a lot of food around the place as well. It also strikes me that another benefit of this as it goes on over time is that people will no longer have to move away from their homes in order to get jobs, and it may even be that, you know, they can help father or grandfather or whatever doing whatever it is he's doing in his shed. And so you might end up with families being able to live and work together, support each other with the childcare, and all of that's really expensive because of the way things are set up at the moment as well.
Yeah, well, the way things are set up at the moment in regards to children are set up that way in order to separate the children from the family structure.
Yeah.
So they're shoved into nurseries and kindergarten so that the mothers can, both mother and father can go to work.
Yeah.
And then the children are indoctrinated in the nurseries to, well, the main thrust of present educational system is to eliminate constructive, deductive, and independent thought. The main thrust of the educational system in the kingdom is to foster that. And so the system that which we'd be using would be the Shetin system, which has been mentioned in the Anastasia books from Vladimir Maigret, where it is normal that children will pass A-level exams after between 3 and 4 years of primary education.
Yeah.
People say, that's impossible, but what about the girl in Wales? I can't remember where now, but it goes back a few years. She got her BSc in physics at the age of 11.
Yeah, I know it's not unheard of, and presumably the aim of this education system would be to teach people how to think for themselves and perhaps how to realise when they're having the wool pulled over their eyes as well.
Yeah, this is it. Independent thinking is the be-all and end-all, and which is why the present education system is designed to eliminate that, so people don't question what's going on. Say, hey, wait a minute, there's a better way to do this, or this makes no sense. They just say, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. You know, when they have the noses rubbed into it, you know, like, you know, saying that an Arab who'd actually been dead for 2 years in a cave in Afghanistan, with the help of 2 mobile phones, managed to set the entire North American air defense system out of service. You know, if you believe that, you know, what sort of brain have you got?
Yeah, indeed, and we do see more and more of that, don't we, around the place.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is 9/11, you know.
Yeah, it strikes me that all this is based on a fundamental misunderstanding, to wit, that the actual wealth of a nation or a state or whatever we want to call the administrative unit, its actual wealth is in the genius of its people.
Exactly.
And in their ability to apply that genius to the projects of their locale and their own kind of unique way of approaching the world. And it'd be really good to see that sort of thing coming back.
Yeah. This is it. This is why the kingdom will generate wealth, because it works for the people and not for the elite.
Mm.
And there's a tiny number of elite who want to have all the money, and everybody else should create the wealth and give it to them. And in the kingdom, you create the wealth, you keep it.
Mm. And by doing things like destroying homemade sewage farms and by completely stripping out everything in what was effectively a people's bank, they're making it now really, really obvious that that is what they want to do, aren't they? It couldn't be any more in people's faces now.
No, we just need to get it out there. Okay, only the independent news is reporting it, of course, but sooner or later, people are going to ask it, well, why is this piece of country no longer in the Federal Republic, And why is this people, and why are these people so much more prosperous than we are? What's the difference? But of course, the kingdom will have its own newspapers and radio stations, and they won't be controlled by Mr. Rockefeller.
Has it got any means of sort of independent journalism currently?
Quite limited at the moment, but it's not one of the high priorities. It will naturally evolve as people move into the kingdom and set that up. Mm.
It's just that it would strike me that particularly with examples such as what happened to the bank, actually some means of being able to publish and disseminate that information reliably might be actually more valuable than it at first appears.
It definitely is, but it's a question of you're building up a new state with limited resources. Where do you focus first?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. But this is going to do us a lot of good. It's going to potentially generate a lot of working capital and also bring a lot of high powered people into the kingdom. And then some of these things that, you've mentioned are going to go.
Yeah.
They're going to really take off.
Well, it sounds like certain parts of the judiciary are almost bound to be in favour of it, judging by the decisions they're coming to in the existing GDR.
Yeah, well, it's not only the judiciary, it's at least 80% of the police are with us. I mean, they're saying to us, as soon as you can pay my salary, let me know and I'll come and join you.
Must have been the BaFin must have heard them saying that. They thought that's a good reason for removing all the money.
I know there are special stormtroopers selected for emotional deficiencies, which they use for jobs like that. And the normal police, they hate them. These are the super violent ones.
Yes, which we're seeing everywhere, aren't we? Effectively militarized police who seem to be under some sort of influence when they're out on the streets.
Yeah. Well, they're selected for narcissist personality, which means that they don't feel to have any personal responsibility for anything whatsoever. And if they get orders to do that, they'll go and do that because that's what they're paid for. And they don't think, they can't think, they can't feel. And that's why they do it, and which is why the normal police hate them, because they're not, what they're doing contravenes what the police stand for. So, yeah.
Okay, let's just return quickly to the business of the money and the kingdom before we kind of move on to a bit of stuff about health and things like that, because I know I'd really like to talk to you about that. How, given that as far as we can gather, what happens in most of the world is that money is created when real live flesh and blood individuals sign a loan note or something. That creates the money, which is then published and lent to governments at interest, and the interest is never published. This obviously leads you to an economy, for want of a better word, which is guaranteed to collapse. How does the kingdom decide how much money it's going to produce, and how does it get it into circulation?
Okay, that's very easy. The currency, there are two at the moment. There's the initial one, which is called the Engel, which is being replaced by the Neudeutsche Mark. These are backed by property, by machines, by businesses owned by the kingdom. So the amount of money in circulation is never greater than the amount of value available to guarantee it.
Okay, and that value is only in capital goods. It's not in things like labor and work outstanding and stuff like that.
No. It's only in terms of physical things that you can get hold of, because you don't actually need any more money than that if you are in a state where the only crime mentioned in the Constitution is charging interest.
Yeah.
And that's the Kingdom of Germany. Mm. If there is no interest, that is, if there is no mechanism by which money can be created out of thin air, then, you know, it just doesn't happen. And so you've no inflation. And you see, money is just a medium for exchanging goods and services. It's a symbolic representation of worth.
And so long as it's not being abused, it should work reasonably well.
Well, it always has done, and until the banks got involved in it. and started creating phantom money.
Yeah. I guess the other thing is that producing your money on the basis of the capital available in a situation, A, as you say, where you're not charging interest or doing any of the other, the moving on of negotiable instruments and all that kind of stuff. But also, as you pointed out earlier, I guess if you're not having to produce it to pay tax on something every time it moves and things like that, that also seriously reduces the amount of money you have to have available for the system to run properly.
Yes, it does. There's never any need for any more money than the available value. Now, this means that anybody who creates wealth can create their own money.
Right. Yeah.
Which means that they could then go to the bank and say, I have sold products to one of your customers, which are worth so much, and he is guaranteeing the value, and the bank says, okay, well, we'll give you the money then. And it's a way in which money is created as an effect of value, not in the hope of it becoming valuable.
That's presumably how our Bills of Exchange Act was supposed to work over here, when people can produce promissory notes of their own which have value in the system. I would guess they must have been based on that kind of thinking.
Probably, but they were then subverted by the banks. But I don't know indeed. Incidentally, do you know who owns your money?
Well, it certainly doesn't seem to be me. I've always thought that it was thought it was owned by the bank and rented to the government. That was my impression, but I must admit I haven't looked at it too closely.
Well, no, this actually goes back to a judgment in the House of Lords in 1843. I sent you the link, incidentally, from YouTube.
Oh, right, yes, this is the... hang on, I have got that up somewhere. Yeah, I remember that. I've got it. I'll post it into the chat box whilst you're talking. The money confiscation link.
Yeah. Yeah, and basically, money in your pocket belongs to you, right?
Yeah.
If you pay it into the bank, it ceases to become your property.
That's right. I remember that. It belongs to the bank as soon as you put it under the piece of glass, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that means if the bank lose it, tough shit. It's got nothing to do with you. You can't have it back.
That's presumably also how they managed to shave 20% off Cypriot bank accounts, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they can just go, well, look, we're only giving... As far as I gather, the only thing they're obliged to give you back is the any interest that's payable on the account, which is, again, quite ironic, isn't it?
Well, no, actually, if you demand your money back before the bank goes bust, then you are a preferred creditor and you get the cream off the top. If you let the bank go bust, then you pretty well lost everything, because the preferred creditors are A, other banks, and B, the taxman. And if there's anything left over, which of course there won't be if the bank's gone bust, then it's divided amongst the unsecured creditors, which means the people who actually deposited money with the bank. And there is only one exception in the entire Western world, and that is the Königliche Reichsbank.
Yeah.
You can put money in there. What I actually do is you pay your money in pounds or euros or dollars. And with that, you can then buy Neudeutsche Mark, which means then you can be active upon the Kadari Mart and amongst other places, as well as any territory which has moved its jurisdiction to the kingdom. And the kingdom then has this other currencies which they can use to purchase materials which they need from outside.
I guess once we realise that the money that's owed by the banks is mostly owed to other banks and the taxman, we suddenly realise why it is that they were so keen to prevent any banks going bust when the last so-called crisis hit.
Mm. Mm. A manufactured crisis to justify, amongst other things, Merkel and Co. using the property of the German people to guarantee the debts of the banks.
Yeah.
And most of the debts are phantom debts.
Yes. Yeah, and they're going to have to steal everybody's money in order to look like they're trying to pay it, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm. So we just say, no thanks, sunshine, we'll do things differently.
So have there been other banks like the one you're talking about? Have there been other banks that have tried to do things in a slightly more reasonable fashion who've also had the rug pulled from under them?
Yes, the People's Bank of Libya.
Yeah.
Where the country was destroyed because it was one of the banks were not owned by Rothschild.
Yeah. I gather that that's the true definition of the axis of evil was, countries that don't have a private central bank. So that would have been Libya and Syria and Iraq and Iran. I think for a while, Russia might be in there as well now, because when the Iron Curtain came down, it basically gave all of its industry to the mafia, who turned them profitable, and they, of course, don't necessarily use Rothschild banks, I'm sure. Although I bet they're pretty close.
No, it's actually rather different in Russia. The mafia took over the economy and gave it to the banking cartel. Putin worked his way slowly up, right to the top, and then he took over the mafia, chucked out the people who wouldn't follow his, who were thinking they were going to be giving him orders, put in his own people, reconfiscated the natural resources which the mafia had given to the banking cartel, and started using the wealth of Russia to rebuild Russia for the Russian people. That's why the banking cartel doesn't like him.
Right, okay. I wasn't aware of that.
Yep. There's a lot of black propaganda. In fact, a couple of months ago, the government of Holland formally apologized to Putin for the black propaganda against him being put out by the press in Holland.
Wow, that is interesting. I mean, it does seem to me that if the mainstream media, for want of a better description, is having a go at somebody, then they're probably all right.
Yeah.
They seem to be wholly in support of people who are clearly not all right.
Yeah. Anyway,
I'll tell you what. I'll put on a couple of tunes so we can have a 5 or 10 minute break, and you can go and have a spoonful of honey, as recommended by the chat box there. See if you can calm your throat down a bit.
Haven't got any honey.
You haven't. You got.
Well, we've got here. So there's some pomegranate elixir. I don't know whether it'll do me any good. It tastes absolutely foul, so it must be good.
I've always found that it's a bit strange. I've always found I use a proprietary brand of cough medicine called Vino's, which always...
Oh, yeah, I remember it. Yeah.
It always seems to work for me. It's getting harder to find. And, do you know, I don't think I ever had to finish a bottle. It always seemed to calm it down. But I was reading recently that it's very popular, but I was reading recently that everybody's a bit surprised by this, because apparently there are no active ingredients in it at all. I think it's just its ability to coat the throat a little bit, easier.
There are a lot of active ingredients, just that they're non-pharmaceutical.
Yeah. Well, what I'll do is I'll put on 5 or 6 minutes of music so we can go and get ourselves some more water or whatever, and then come back to you, and we can have a quick chat about health and what we think about that, if that's okay with you.
Yep.
That's okay. Brilliant. Just stay on the line, and we'll get back to it in, like I say, about 6 minutes or so. In the meantime, we'll play Quark, Strangeness and Charm for the people out there in the chat box. So you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we're in live and wide-ranging talk with Karma Singh. And there we go. That was Chris Barber and Guy Taylor with Jules Holland doing Angle Grinder Blues. Please don't worry, I'm doing all I can, which I'm sure we are. And we're joined on the line again by Karma. Are you still there, Karma?
Yes, I'm still here.
Very good. Well, I thought we'd get to talk a little bit about health and how we might look after ourselves a bit better, because this is an area in which you do a lot of work, isn't it?
My profession is actually a healer, and of course it starts off with people come to you with illnesses, but then you go more and more into what surrounds the people in order to find out what is actually making them ill, and then how to correct it. So you end up changing the entire political system, because that present one is a major disease.
So it was your interest in health that led you towards the kind of Kingdom of Germany project, I guess.
But health is not restricted to mere physical health. It's the health of humanity as a whole. And when you have a major cancer running wild called the banking cartel, as a healer, it lies within your aegis to do something about it.
I guess so, because really, to a certain extent, our internal health is a reflection of the external world we find ourselves in, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it's to many people in orthodox medicine, it would be an interest. It's an interesting approach, isn't it, to try to approach, I guess, the cause, the actual engine of disease, rather than just trying to deal with the symptom. Because by and large, I think we're led to believe in the GP surgery that we catch something. And that then we've got to deal with it, which doesn't strike me as being a very adequate proposition.
Well, it's not even true. You see, you're told that, you have caught this germ, but you were born with almost all germs known to humanity in your body, present. And they don't do anything until the correct stimulus comes along. And they start doing their job, and then you call it an illness. And then you do something quite stupid, you attack the symptoms and leave the illness intact.
Whereas, of course, the symptoms are an indicator that something needs attending.
Yeah. And the way to start getting into this is to read Professor Bruce Lipton's stuff on, I think his first book, Intelligent Cells.
Yeah.
But, this is a basic introduction to epigenetics. But as you go into it, you find that the actual basis of our so-called health system was a deliberate fraud by a certain Louis Pasteur and his compil Robert Koch, mm-hmm. who promoted this idea of the infectious disease, although both of them knew with absolute certainty, hard proof that it is not true. It is impossible. It cannot be. It does not exist.
Did they know they knew that, did they? Oh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah. Well, Pierre Deschamps, who was professor of biology in the University of Paris, and is the guy from whom Pasteur stole most of his ideas, he told Pasteur, when Pasteur came up with this theory, he told, no, that is not true. That is impossible because of this and this and this and this. And Robert Koch, his colleagues, demonstrated to him right in front of his eyes that it is not true. And still, they both decided. You see, it's like at that time, the thing that would guarantee fame and fortune was discovering the cause of disease. And they both decided for fame and fortune instead of truth. And that is the backbone of our present so-called health system.
Well, I mean, if it was the case that people got sick as a result of catching germs or whatever, then doctors would seldom be in any state to attend their own surgery, would they?
Yeah. Well, it's even more blatant than that. You see, the definition of an epidemic is that between 1% and 4% of the people who come into contact with the so-called disease germs actually get ill. That is, 96 to 99% of the people are completely unaffected. Why? That blows the theory of infectious disease out the water, just that one statistic.
Yeah, because you would expect, well, I would have expected an epidemic to involve much higher percentages than that, really. But if we see flu and colds and things going around, we see people who are close to each other, by and large, catching them, don't we, rather than, everybody round and about them.
Well, people who are in resonance with each other, which is usually members of the family or work colleagues, who regularly exchange information with each other, unconsciously, energetically, they would tend to also transfer the signals which say, okay, now's the time to do this sort of detoxification. But people that they might meet at the bus stop, they're not in resonance with them, so they don't pass it on. Which is why it's always very, very limited. And almost all the things that we've been taught to call illnesses are in fact natural healing, natural detoxification processes, just like flu. It's a natural detoxification process. It's the elimination of death fear, which is why after a bout of flu, you look and feel younger.
Right. I've often wondered about flu and colds and things and the fact that they come at the end of the summer or into the winter or whatever. So you're saying it's a sort of a cyclic cleaning out process, really.
Yeah, well, I've actually written one major book on this called The Flu Fairy Tale. It's in, only available as an ebook at the moment, but you can download it from the website of the same name, theflufairytale.com. Actually, Bruce Lipton wrote the foreword for the book, so, you know, which is quite nice of him.
That was quite a good coup, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, Bruce and I met in 2008 and we hit it off straight away and, yeah.
So I know, his book, The Biology of Belief, I read that several times and I'd say it was one of the best books I've read, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it is. That's what it's called in German, not intelligent cells. But the biology belief is called intelligent cells in German, sorry.
Okay.
So it's a biology belief is what I meant. Yeah. And so I have Bruce's private secret email address and he has my secret email address. And every now and then we meet up when he's in Europe.
Very good. He's still working hard, isn't he? I remember reading it was way back in the late 60s that he first discovered that putting three sets of identical cells into different Petri dishes and providing them with a different environment led to different outcomes.
Yeah.
Hence showing that we're not necessarily the slave to our genes, really.
But, well, showing that then, but if you take the Human Genome Project, which was supposed to create a catalogue of the entire human gene system, according to the theory of genetic determinism, when it was first propounded, would require 184,000 genes by the beginning of this century, after being up to 214,000 genes. In 2003, the Human Genome Project published its results, and there are 20,500 human genes. So less than 10% of what would be necessary for the theory of genetic determination to have any sort of scientific foundation.
It also means, I guess, that there's not much possibility of finding too many cures in amongst the genes either. You know, these magic bullets they were looking for with the Genome Project.
Yeah, that's what they're looking for. But according to Bruce's work, well, not just Bruce's, but quite a few others, the genes are a passive database which the cells can use and modify to create proteins which they need to react to the changes in the environment. So a cell is quite capable of producing more than 1,000 different proteins from one gene by the cell being intelligent enough to modify the genetic structure to create a completely new protein, one that never existed before.
Yeah. And we know the cells work on that kind of basis because even in the liver's got, I think it's several hundred potential functions and needs to have function specific cells and it somehow decides, doesn't it, which ones are going to be made next.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the cells decide. The skin of the cell, the membrane of the cell is the cell's brain. And all cells are intelligent. All cells have got a brain. And they communicate and they cooperate. Much better than humans do, although a human being is a community of 70 billion cells. That's English billion, American trillion.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't hear very many people making that distinction. Yeah. Yeah. So ours is, 1,000 million. Yeah. 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 So what we're suggesting really is that, rather than being a matter of, germs or whatever, disease is a kind of matter of resonance. It's information being passed between people who are used to receiving information from each other. And presumably the resolution can be a matter of resonance as well, can it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, you feed in the healing resonance. And I actually did this with one of my goddaughters on the phone. Like, she phoned me up. She was supposed to have her final English examinations to be a professional translator that day, and she woke up with an enormously heavy cold, could hardly breathe. Now, a cold is, amongst other things, a discharge of sadness energy. The opposite, of course, is, I can't think of the English word, but let's say happiness is a more appropriate word. It's Begeisterung in German, if anybody wants to look it up quickly. And if you feed this into the lungs and smile in the lungs at the same time, you can complete the process at an incredible speed, and literally 15 minutes later, the cold had completely gone.
It's a pretty amazing thing to have done, isn't it? I've been recently rereading Lynn McTaggart's Intention Experiment, and one of the things that comes out really strongly from that book is that distance healing is a very, very highly validated skill and practice that does seem to work really well.
Yeah, well, I have quite a number of patients that over the years that done that. Oh, the word I was looking for was elation.
Right, okay, yeah.
Or enthusiasm.
Yeah, which means imbued with the spirit of God, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that is what will process a cold within minutes.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, epigenetics, which you mentioned earlier, is basically the study of kind of biological mechanisms that turn genes on and off, isn't it? That can be done by signaling too, because far from, you know, being stuck with the genes that we're born with, what you're saying suggests that they're actually very, very versatile in the moment.
Well, not the genes. It's the way in which the cells use them. The genes don't change, but what the cell does, it makes a copy of the gene and then modifies the copy to produce the protein that it needs. But the genes, the cells, you know, the ones that you're born with, never change. They're a passive database.
Right. So we are potentially designed to deal even with things that haven't been seen on Earth before.
Well, I think I can't remember what it was, but a typical man in the street, as they say, actually uses 12% of the genome. The rest is so-called junk DNA. For some reason, it doesn't appear to be used. So it's 88% latent potential, and nobody knows what can be achieved with it.
And that's something, funny enough, that's just being discussed in the chat box here. Lee's put in that we've got 97% roughly of our genes are currently inactive, which is described as junk DNA by Orthodoxy. And I've just asked him, do you think it's junk or is it waiting to be activated? And the consensus so far seems to be that it's waiting to be activated, possibly by light.
Yeah. Well, there's no waiting. It's actually happening.
Yeah.
Which is why you're getting people developing abilities which didn't exist before. And you see quite a few of them on YouTube, actually, if you hunt around a bit. But it will become more and more prevalent as more and more people suddenly discover that they have these abilities, which they just weren't there before.
Yeah. Yes, it is my firm suspicion that one of the reasons why the world management team is acting so outrageously at the moment is that is the main thing that is trying to keep us most distracted from. Because if people were to find out how closely the environment supports them and how magical their responses can be, then the game would start changing quite quickly.
Well, they're not succeeding. Point of fact, they're increasing the interest in these new abilities. That's the effect they're having.
Well, I mean, if nothing else, we're seeing more and more people moving towards complementary therapy. And to my knowledge, I know that a fair number of GPs are getting themselves trained up in things like Indian head massage and kinesiology and the like.
Yeah, that's a term I detest, alternative therapies, because it implies that it's complementary medicine, which is even worse. It's like you're saying, well, this is a little something extra that maybe you can use when normal medicine doesn't work the way you think it ought to.
I stand corrected on that one. That was sloppy use of words. I'll slap my wrist.
Which is why I insist on using the term real healing or true healing.
Yeah. Yes, because we don't see a lot of healing coming out of allopathic medicine, do we?
It's not intended to do so.
No.
All it's there for is to suppress symptoms to buy time for a healing. That's it.
Yes, it certainly seems to me that the not healthy service, as I call it over here, seems to be in the business of enabling people to live with their symptoms and maybe give them a few more on the way through, actually, in fairness. And it is quite strange that the NHS in England was originally set up around 5 homeopathic hospitals that were apparently functioning and operating pretty effectively before all of this started happening. Mm. And I guess homeopathy is really a matter of resonance as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, if you go into quantum beam physics, you'll see the way in which homeopathy works described perfectly. In fact, I did a video interview with Bruce Lipton a few years ago in London. It's on my website, KarmaSingh TV, on the interviews lib, if you scroll down a bit, you'll find that I was interviewing about homeopathy, and he was explaining to me that they're actually, contrary to what the medical industry was saying, that homeopathy is just a hoo-hoo, witch doctor nonsense, there have actually been two Nobel Prizes won for describing exactly how homeopathy works.
And the basis of it has been replicated in so many laboratories, and also, I mean, Emoto's work on water and all of that has shown that water is a programmable substance. It's not just H2O. It's much more complex than that, isn't
it? Yeah.
And, I remember when, there's a story I have told before. I'll tell it again briefly though. A friend of mine, Synchro, she's known on the radio show. She was given a homeopathic remedy to prove when she went, on holiday to Spain.
Yeah.
And as you probably know, the homeopath doesn't tell you what the remedy is. What she wants is your feedback on what happened when you took it. And, they stay up all night in Spain and party quite a lot. So Jess took her remedy and she did all of that. And towards the end of the party, she headed off up the mountain, and it was the night of a full moon. And when she got up the top of the hill, she stood there and she howled and she howled and she howled until she howled herself hoarse and went home. And when she got back to England and told this to the homeopath told her that the remedy she'd been given to prove was wolf's milk.
Aha!
And I've actually heard many more stories like that, which, I mean, I'm a user of homeopathy myself. I carry around a little kit because I got bitten in my sitting room in Abingdon by a mosquito once on one of my veins. And my hand kind of swelled up like a rubber glove that had been blown up. And the next day, my lower arm swelled up and then my upper arm. And eventually, one of my customers sent me off to the doctor, who gave me some antihistamines. He said it was basically heading up for my lymph system, where it was planning on killing me. And I talked to my homeopath about it, having had that sorted out, and she gave me some little hypericum tablets, and she gave me some hypericum tincture, and she said, you always know when you're being bitten by a mosquito. You feel it straight away. She said, next time, instead of carrying on gardening and making your system work hard, take one of these hypericum tablets, go and sit in the shade somewhere, and just drop the hypericum tincture on the bite. And so I carry those things around with me now. It's happened to me three or four times since. They seem to unerringly hit a vein of some sort. And I've not had the problem of the swelling again. I can feel the homeopathic compounds working straight away on the actual bite. And it's always seemed to me to be thoroughly effective. I know people who are using it on horses and dogs, and it seems to work on them as well. And if it's just juju, that doesn't really strike me as being, you know, that's not what I'd see happening.
Yeah, well, my personal first experience with homeopathy was quite similar to that. I see, as a child, until puberty, I had chronic bladder infections, you know, every few weeks, and the medicos were never able to get it in grip. Then at puberty, it disappeared. And then back in 2000 or 2001, I can't remember now, it suddenly reappeared. I thought, well, I'm not going to go to medicos again because I know they can do very well. I'd actually just got into contact with this woman who was an osteopath, but also a homeopath. And I said, well, can you do anything about it? And she said, well, hold up your hands and spread your fingers. So I did. And she said, you've inherited a syphilis miasma. And this was quite amazing. She could, just by the position of the thumbs, she could see that. So she gave me the appropriate homeopathic thing. And within 2 days, it disappeared and has not yet reappeared. So 15 years later, or 14 years later. And then we did some digging. You know, where have I got a syphilis miasma? Now, a miasma is something which is actually carried over from a previous generation. So it's just an energy form. It's not physically present, but it's energetically present and causes problems with the physical body. Well, tremendous numbers of people have tuberculosis miasma, which is generally cleared up in a couple of days with homeopathy. But anyway, we dug into this, and it turned out my grandfather's brother, who was a captain on one of the, a senior officer, I'm not quite sure if he was a captain or not, on a major British warship in the Second World War. And I was, as a child, I was fascinated by the Royal Navy and the Second World War. And I had all these plastic assembly models from Airfix and whatnot. And every time I asked about my great uncle, immediately everybody changed the subject. Nobody would talk about him. And then we finally puzzled out, he actually died of syphilis.
Right. I find that very interesting. A, because it means that the miasma, you describe it as a kind of, an energy that makes that's a bit like the water having memory, isn't it? And it's coming through in the water of your system, and it's an energetic. So again, it's a resonance structure in as far as it's a structure at all.
Yeah, well, in the research center in Hamburg, we do a tremendous amount of work on that. There's tremendous numbers of people who are suffering from ancestral problems. So, you know, the miasma is there of a problem which doesn't exist now, so it can't be solved now. It's just making people ill. And we worked out ways of sending this informational energy back to where it belongs, so that then it can be processed where at the point of origin and stop messing up the life of somebody who's got nothing to do with it.
I guess stuff that's turning up as an energetic manifestation can be sorted with an energetic manifestation.
Indeed, indeed. And now you've got on the subject of manifestation, conscious manifestation. Well, maybe we'll spend a couple of minutes, if we could, talking about The Key to Luck.
Yeah, yes indeed. Yeah, I enjoyed reading that. It's your book that the version I've got is called The Anatomy of Luck, but it's because it came from foreign parts. It's been renamed for sale in the so-called United Kingdom, hasn't it?
Well, in the English-speaking world, the point was that the German title, the original German title was something quite different, but then we renamed it and became much more successful because the Germans are very analytic. In the sense that they want to know, has this been certified by somebody? And so The Anatomy of Luck sounds as though, okay, this is a scientific treatise which somebody has approved, so we'll buy it and use it. But that doesn't appeal to the English-speaking mentality.
We prefer a metaphor.
Yeah, so it wasn't doing, the English translation wasn't doing a whole lot with the title The Anatomy of Luck, so we changed the title to The Key to Luck, and it's doing much better.
And I think this is a very important topic because I've come across it several times in my short life. I guess the first time I came across intent and manifestation and how to make it work from you was when, as a youngster, I had a bit of interest in the Western occult, and I did a bit of study as to how people were casting spells and why they worked. More recently, I came across a book, I think it was written by a guy called Napoleon Hill, and it was called Think Yourself Rich.
Oh, yeah, Napoleon Hill, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very good little book, actually. It had some quite bizarre social attitudes in it with regards to women and stuff, but in terms of manifestation, it was...
Well, it was written in 1911.
Is that how old it was? Right, yeah.
Yeah,
indeed, and we are the product of our age, aren't we? So how would you sum up the core aim of this little book? What's it designed to do for people?
Well, if I tell you the original title, it'll give you a clue. The original title was the Biology of Prayer. What this actually started, this goes back several decades for me. Why doesn't prayer work? You know, it's like you're expected, it's demanded of you that you take it on faith that God will answer your prayers, but nothing ever happens. I thought, there's got to be something screwed here. So I talked to a couple of vicars and didn't get anything resembling an answer from them. And, you know, over the years, it's been a sort of occasional research project, picking up bits of knowledge here, there, and everywhere. Like I learned from a Brahmin priest the power of truth. And one of the Brahmin teachings is that if you never speak anything other than truth, your voice will develop such an enormous power that you can change the world by decreeing that it be so. Oh, that's quite interesting. From an Indian shaman, I learned a few other things. From a Korean healing teacher, I learned about mudras and why the hands should be held in a particular way, et cetera. And then in 2008, what's his name? I forgot his name temporarily. Bruce Lipton's Bruce Lipton's best friend, what's his name, did the videos, The Divine Matrix, wrote the books, The Divine Matrix. I've forgotten his name.
I think I perhaps don't know it. Maybe it'll pop up in the chat box, or it'll come back to you.
Yeah, one or the other. Anyway, it was actually in The Divine Matrix, when I was watching the DVD, that he actually gave me the two missing pieces. What had actually happened, if we go back in history, the early Christians almost brought the Roman Empire to its knees. Because they knew how to manifest anything and everything they wanted. They were taught this. It was a part of the original Christian teachings, the absolute personal power, absolute personal responsibility. And the Emperor Diocletian had done everything he could to suppress them, and nothing worked, because no matter what he took away from them, before he got back home, they recreated it. And then Constantine said, oh, well, I can't continue like this. Constantine was Diocletian's successor, and his grip on power was quite shaky anyway, and then he was looking, casting around for ways to improve his grip on power, and he came up with the idea, he did a deal with the Christian bishops to declare Christianity the state religion, and the bishops should then teach their followers that the emperor has been appointed by God to rule over their worldly affairs. And part of the deal was that the Bible would be heavily edited to, amongst other things, remove the teachings which were making the Christians so personally powerful. And so two of the four rules of prayer were actually deleted from the Bible.
What are the two that are left in there? Put you on the spot.
You'd have to read my book. I can't tell you.
I meant to have a copy of it with me, but unfortunately it's 20 miles down the road at the moment, so I can't look it up. I'll tell you what, I'll bring it up next week. can you remember the two? Can you remember the two that were missing?
Well, the way I've quoted them in the Key to Luck, I've used the King James Bible, so it's sort of early Georgian English. Or late Jacobean English, which, because you put them into modern English, they become even less intelligible. But the point is this, two of the four laws of prayer were no longer taught. They were made a state secret, with the effect that from the fourth century onwards, Christians were taught a useless ersatz for prayer. And the only people who had access to the power, the real power, were the elite, which initially was Constantine and friends. And then a couple of hundred years later, the Knights Templar got hold of it and very rapidly became such a power that they almost toppled the Papal Imperium.
Yeah.
And then the knowledge disappeared again. And it's now reappeared in The Key to Luck. And The Key to Luck is a simple handbook that shows you step by step by step how you can use your natural power. Everybody has it. There are no exceptions. Exactly how you can use your natural power to create, to manifest anything and everything that you want.
And it is the power of directed intent, isn't it?
It's much more than that. The intent is only a small part of it. You need to know where the seat of your power is, how to focus your power, how to combine your power, and where your transmitter is that gives the instructions to the universe on what the universe is.
So what are those various critical points that we need to understand?
Pages 83 to 117, I think. Sorry, couldn't resist that. The seat of power is in the abdomen, and the heart is the transmitter. The brain in your skull is the receiver. Its prime function is to receive information from the quantum field and bring it into an orderly manner so that it becomes available for the main brain. The power is in your abdomen. The transmitter is your heart. Your heart has already been measured with a radiant field of 20 meters. And it is presumed that it goes much, much further. And in quantum field theory, says that your heart is connected with every furthest corner of the universe. Hmm. So this is the transmitter that you use to give your instructions to the universe. You just need to know how to bring everything together into one point so that you give a coherent instruction.
And, of course, whilst we're not doing that, we are, by definition, sending out pretty much incoherent instructions, which is perhaps being reflected in the incoherence of the world we see about us.
It's actually much worse than that. The point is this. Your life is never, ever controlled by willpower, by wishes, by beliefs, anything like that. What you experience is what you expect. And your expectations are all unconscious. Their expectations are based upon the judgments that you made around your early childhood events. And that has become the structure of your life. And these expectations have direct access to your power, which is why they always manifest themselves. And what the book is about is reprogramming your expectations so that they become life-affirming instead of life-destructive.
Yeah. Yeah. I've recently been given access to a method called havening, which is part, I think, part product of, NLP. And it's a set of, affirmations and, touching various body points to get rid of old and stuck ideas and enable new ones to take place. And apparently what the movements do is enable the brain's neurons to release potassium that's got stuck there and let magnesium come in instead. And apparently it seems to work pretty well. I must admit, the things I've been told to concentrate on are certainly fixing themselves pretty readily.
It does. It's a very, very useful technique. What for me is so really thrilling is there are so many different techniques all aimed at the same thing. I mean, one of them, I have the key to look. I also have the Harmony headphone, which is a way of using quantum physics to delete destructive belief systems. And it does it through quantum ordering and natural resonance. It's an amazing piece of equipment. It costs a little bit more than the anatomy of the key to look, but it works.
So what is it? Is it a set of headphones that you wear, or?
No, it's called a headphone set. It's actually three Harmony Evolutions. And a cheap headphone is just the way, a comfortable way of holding them in the right place. So left ear, right ear, and fontanelle. And what that does, it fills your head with ordered energy. And the thing is, the destructive habits that you've learnt or created need chaotic energy to stay in power. And the useful habits need ordered energy to function properly. So you fill your head with ordered energy, and literally what happens is that the destructive habits suddenly they starve, and the synaptic change which had been holding that habit actually breaks, and that just deletes permanently the habit. It just does not exist anymore.
And you've been using these for some time now.
I was given the first experimental set for Christmas in 2004 by Joachim, who actually invented the technology, and it took me 7 months to work out what it was for. But I've been using them regularly since 2005. For a long time, I was using them every day because it shifts so much stuff so fast. I mean, I no longer use them every day, but I've actually worn out three headphones.
Sounds like a useful piece of tackle to have.
Oh, it is. It is. Very useful.
So what exactly is the Harmony Evolution? What's it, is it a chip or layers of, organic material? What is it?
It's a little bit difficult to describe very, very quickly, but it's a processor, which is actually built up through with several layers, and each layer has several hundred submicroscopic coils and condensers crystallized into them and then three-dimensionally cross-connected. And that what you then have is, the material is a dielectricum. That's an electron mirror.
Mm-hmm.
What you then have is a filter which allows electrons to enter the processor in any state whatsoever, but they can only leave it along their own individual perfect frequency path, which has the effect of correcting the position and the frequency of the electrons, which has the effect of correcting the position and frequency of the atoms, which has the effect of correcting the frequency and position of the molecules, etc., etc., etc. And from this causational level, because an electron is not a stable particle, it's something which is constantly switching between a wave and a particle. And that's that is the source of material. Correcting the informational structure there corrects the informational structure and so the physical structure all the way through. Not only for organic stuff, but also for machines. So any system works better if its electron energy systems, informational system structure is in optimal order.
Wicked.
What the harmonic technology does.
So you can use them singly as well, then. You could have one attached to your computer, say.
Well, you could, yep. But there's a whole big website. Let me just tell you what it is. It's harmonyunited.com. And there are more than 1,000 pages on there, so enjoy reading.
Yes, I was looking at it the other night, actually. There's some pretty interesting recommendations from people who've had really good results.
Mm.
Oh, by the way, the name of the man you were forgetting was Greg Braden.
Yes,
earlier
yes,
on.
That's it.
Yeah.
He's amazingly small. When I met him in Hamburg a couple of years ago, he wears built-up shoes, but even then he's 3 inches shorter than I am.
I've read some good books by Greg Braden, I must admit, about the zero-point field.
Yeah.
Is he still turning out new stuff, do you know?
I don't really know, to be honest. I'm much more heavily involved with Bruce than with Greg.
Yeah.
And Lynn McTaggart, of course, who's our homegrown heroine.
Her book, The Field, was a real life changer for me.
Yeah,
Partly because it wasn't just a matter of reading stuff that she was saying. I'd already come across quite a lot of it in because I've been keeping myself healthy using all manner of things that don't involve going to GPs for years now. And I've had really miraculous results from it. And which is why I'm so much interested in the power of luck and successful manifestation, because I feel that to a certain extent we might be able to get political results by approaching the system on its own level. But I'm with Einstein in believing that the actual solution to the problem is not going to be found at the level of the problem. So no. our personal concentration in improving our own manifestation, improving our own coherence, to use a word you used, is probably one of the best things we can do.
Well, it is. We've stopped 4 attempts to start World War III. We've stopped them by mass manifestation, the thousands of people who use the book all doing the same manifestation, and it stopped 4 attempts.
Excellent. So you've got people who've read the book and have, to some extent, mastered the techniques working together.
Yeah, well, the techniques are not difficult to master. You just, and I kept the book simple so that everybody could understand it and everybody can use it. And, every now and then we do, I coordinate a mass manifestation and they really work. It's quite amazing.
Yeah. Do you find there's better times to do it or can it just be done at any time?
Can be done at any time. The optimal time, of course, is the quieter time of day, which is between 4 and 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
Which is why when you go and live in an ashram, you're woken at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes. Yeah, I'm aware. It also tends to be the time of the morning. I find if I'm going to wake up and be disturbed, it's around 3-4 o'clock in the morning that it happens to me. I'm basically pretty chipper and happy individual, but sometimes at that time in the morning, I can find it a bit difficult to be so positive.
Ah, then you've got a problem with your liver, which follows on from your strong allergic reaction to the mosquito bite. It also signifies problem with your liver. I would recommend for you a liver detox according to...
I know the man, Moritz.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, in fact, I did try one of those about a year ago and it didn't work out come the end, but I know what went wrong. And I have in fact been doing a little bit of that in November. I had a quick go as well, but come the spring, which I think is a better time to do it, I'll do the full 1 week flush and colonic irrigation and all of that and do it properly again.
Yeah, but you know, once is not enough. You need to do it every month for a year, because it's only third or the fourth time that you actually start bringing out the really heavy, sticky stuff.
Okay, and it's all right to do it once a month, is it?
That's it. That's the plan. Andreas's plan says do it once every month for a year, every 5 years.
Right, yeah. Well, that'd turn out to be quite pricey with that many irrigations, it would.
No, you don't need the irrigations.
I see.
It doesn't, it costs almost nothing. I mean, what you're doing, you're drinking 6 liters of apple juice, which you might drink anyway, and then you need some Epsom salts and a half a grapefruit and some olive oil. I mean, you know, it's
Break back. No, I remember the process itself actually being pretty easy, not unpleasant. It was simply, maybe it was a record, because it was his liver and gallbladder flush I was using. But
yeah.
For some reason I remember it saying that it was necessary to have irrigation before and after. Perhaps that was just for the first one, I don't know. But we've got the book, we'll check it out. I'm actually constantly referencing that book on this show. It's called Timeless Secrets of Health and Rejuvenation. And it's completely full of really, really invaluable, easy to access remedies. Thanks for the diagnosis. It's useful to have these things connected. I never bothered going looking for the actual reason for why I was reacting so badly to the mosquito bites. I'm quite intrigued. It's interesting, isn't it, that the seat of our power is in the abdomen, and we've got lots of sayings in English and stuff referring to gut feelings and gut instincts and a feeling in my gut about something. It suggests that it is something that we should be paying attention to rather than dismissing.
It is. Well, you see, the gut is the body's biggest brain. Now, I know in the medical textbooks it says, no, it isn't. It doesn't have a very complex nerve structure. The point is this. The abdomen is the seat of the brain, which is not physically manifest. There are lots and lots of connection between the abdomen and the non-physical brain. But it has to be non-physical, because to be physical, it will be too slow.
So it's a kind of quantum brain.
Oh, that's a wonderful description. Thank you. We'll call it the quantum brain as from now on, as copyright.
I was actually told that the Chinese ideogram for brain is a complex symbol which actually ties the brain and the stomach together. I think the ancient Chinese do believe that the brain is in the stomach more than as much as in the head.
Well, the physical body has three brains, but it's now 12:20, and I've got to get up at 5 o'clock. And drive several hundred miles.
Well, that sounds fair enough to me. I think you've done us proud tonight, Karma.
Thank you.
So, you doing anything interesting that deserves a 5 o'clock trip in the morning?
Yes. Oh, this I do want to mention while I got you on the phone. I'm doing the first empowerment training of the year, down in Bavaria. And on the 28th of February, is the first empowerment training of the year in the United Kingdom, specifically in Hampshire. Oh, what's the name of the town? It's not far from Bournemouth, anyway. So do go. Let me see if I can very quickly sort you out a link.
You stick it in the Skype and I'll put it in the chat box for people. What sort of things do you cover on your empowerment training days?
Well, the link I want to send you is a complete description of what the empowerment training. And it's about, first of all, correcting a lot of misinformation, and then using the healing transmissions that I give to delete the patriarchal programming and open your connection to angel consciousness, and then teaching you how to use them.
Right.
Now, I think I got it here. Let's have a look.
The thing is that those sort of things that you're talking about there, the new physics and the new stroke old, extremely ancient medicine, voice healing, the work that people are doing with water, all of these, the work that people are doing with intention, all of these things should be bringing more and more to people's mind the fact that these are not only potentially effective, but they're also, in modern terms, explicable as well. We can start to see the dynamics of how these things work. I mean, if every part of the cosmos is connected intimately with every other part of it, then we can see how these kind of connections can be made and how energetic progress can be made.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, the link is in the chat now.
Very good. Oh, I've got it. Okay, I shall take that straight away and put it in the chat box. And I shall thank you very much, Karma, for coming on the show again. I really do appreciate your time. And hopefully I'll have another look at the little book, and I'll do the thing about the prayer next week in the show, so that people don't miss out on that. And it'd be great to stay in touch with regard to what happens with the Kingdom of Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, bit by bit, but especially what happens as a result of what was done to that bank. Cause I, as I say, I come across things when I'm doing this show that just leave me absolutely speechless. And it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing to think that, you know, the supposed forces of probity should be able to come in and do something that is so profoundly and obviously not only illegal but unlawful. So thanks very much for bringing it to our attention. I really enjoyed that story.
Somebody who's listening in, one of my mates, has just sent me a Skype message saying it's in Wimborne in Dorsetshire, not in Hampshire.
That's very good. It's a good job to know there's somebody out there paying attention, isn't it?
Yeah, well, something I wanted to say, actually, a good job he's reminded me, something that I wanted to do for anybody who's listened to this broadcast or listened to the recording, who wants to take part in the empowerment training, if you put in the registration, I am a friend of Dr. Rock, then you'll get a small discount.
Oh, that's very good. There we go. Cool. At last, a reason for listening to the show, folks. Well done, Karma. That's great. I think that's the first gift we've ever given away on 3.5 years of the show. So it's a red letter day. So thanks very much. I really appreciate you coming on. And okay. You get yourself a good night's kip. And best of luck with your empowerment day in Wimborne in Dorsetshire.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks very, very much for the invite, and I hope to hear from you again sometime in the near future.
Yeah, very good. We'll keep in touch on the Skype, and when things turn up, you can come on. You know, it doesn't have to be the whole thing. You can come on just for 20 minutes or so to bring us up to date or something. So
yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Very, very good. Well, thanks for the book. Thanks for the interview, and thanks for all the work you're doing. I look forward to talking to you again soon. There you go, the totally inimitable Ramones there. And do you want to dance? Do we want to dance? Yeah, I think so. Before that, Strategy from Horace X. Karma points out in some of his articles that the things we most need to keep ourselves healthy are organic food, which has been covered muchly on the show, vital water. There's been several shows about that, not only here but elsewhere on People's Internet Radio. Clean air and coherent thought patterns, coherent energy patterns, generally speaking. And being as we've got a few minutes, we referred there to The Field by Lynn McTaggart, which is a completely fabulous book. It's one of the great things about living when we live, is that we have the printing press, we have the internet, and we have people working closely together, so we can get collections of data. People who are working in given fields can go looking at all the work's been done by other people over time and then put it all together in a book for us so that we don't have to go and pick it all up from several different sources. And The Field is one such book. Lynn McTaggart writes really well, and she has been at it for a long time. And The Field is full of absolutely extraordinary data highlighting the energetic connections between everything and everything else, especially between consciousness and everything else. She's also, I think, the editor of What the Doctors Don't Tell You, which is a truly marvellous magazine, especially they have some really excellent editions. She followed up The Field, I think it was her next book, with The Intention Experiment, which is another very interesting book, although not quite so unremittingly exciting as The Field. That's just my opinion, of course. And one of the interesting things in there, you remember Karma was talking about the fact that prayer doesn't appear to work. I don't know whether he got the vicars to agree with that, but it certainly is something that I think many people would agree with. And the intention experiment has got a whole section on prayer, where they were trying to find out whether prayer helped people to heal or not. It's very difficult to do such experiments because there's an awful lot of variables that can't really be taken account of. But one of the conclusions that was reached by several different quite large-scale experiments was that prayer didn't seem to work very well at all in a lot of these cases. Certainly didn't seem to work as well as, say, Reiki does. And I think there are now been physical examinations using light meters, seeing how many photons are being emitted by people when they turn the healing energy on, and it's apparently quite clear that there is an electrical component, a magnetic component, and a component which can only be described as light, which sometimes strengthens many thousands of times when these people start trying to heal at a distance. Prayer, on the other hand, there was one particular experiment I remember reading about in the intention experiment where they tried praying for one bunch of people and not letting them know they were being prayed for, and praying for another bunch of people and letting them know that they were being prayed for. In neither case did it work particularly well, but apparently in the case where people knew they were being prayed about, they actually ended up getting worse results than the controls who weren't being prayed for at all. So the prayer thing's quite interesting, and it is something covered in Karma's Power of Luck. The key to luck, which I'll try and remember to get into next week. I'll actually try and remember to have the book with me. It was supposed to be here this week. One thing that was very interesting in the intention experiment was a guy called Tiller. And what he decided to do was to get some experienced meditators together, because apparently your experienced meditator has more focused and well-trained ability to put intent where it's needed. Because it's not just the intention itself you need. This is, of course, what Lynn McTaggart is investigating, is just exactly what are the circumstances that can amplify intent, focus it, and actually make it useful in manifestation in the outside world. And what this guy Tiller decided to do was he decided to get his meditators to put their intention in a little black electronic box that he designed with an EEPROM chip in it, which is a kind of, you can write it and then it can be read. So he built these little electronic black boxes, and he did a couple of experiments. One of them, the intent was to work with fruit flies, because they're a favourite laboratory critter for whatever reason. And the intent that was put into these particular boxes was that the fruit flies should grow more swiftly, and that they should be stronger than fruit flies in the control group that weren't being exposed to the little black box with the intention in it. And it worked, apparently. It worked pretty well. The fruit flies, on average, were growing 15% faster than their brethren. And not only did they come out much stronger and more healthy, but so did successive generations that were bred from those fruit flies. I think even more impressive than that was what he decided he'd try and do with these little black boxes, is that he would try and affect, either positively or negatively. Specifically, he decided that some of the intent was to raise the pH of water, and some of the boxes contained intent to reduce the pH of water. This is something which can be easily done by the addition of chemicals and things like that, but apparently it's not something that happens naturally very often. And any kind of small increase or decrease in pH would be regarded as significant, because apparently in a human being, if your pH goes up or down by about 0.7, then you're either dying or already dead. So what he did was he set up his laboratory, put a little black box in it, and he had some little black boxes without intent in them as well, and they were all wrapped up so that the guys that were using them had no idea which sort of black box they were dealing with. They were all dealt with by a third party, so that Tiller's mind wasn't going to affect what was going on. And they had pretty spectacular results, really. They were managing to raise, stroke, lower the pH of water in a sample beaker by somewhere over a quarter of a unit of pH, which is actually quite a lot. But what was really interesting was the fact that over time, their experiments became more and more successful. So basically, the more often they did this in the laboratory, the more successful the experiment became. And in a search to try and find out what was going on there, Tiller decided that he was going to monitor the water more carefully. He was going to monitor its conductivity. He was going to monitor several other variables that were apparent in the laboratory, such as the temperature. And what happened was that it turned out, when they started watching these things more closely, that the pH in the water was varying up and down over a 45-minute cycle, and the conductivity of the water was changing as well. Perhaps more remarkable still was that the temperature in the laboratory was going up and down by about 4 degrees. And this was all happening in a coherent cycle over 45 minutes. These variations were happening in tune with each other. And what he said, what Lynn McTaggart says, it's almost as if human intention that had been captured in these little black boxes was somehow conditioning the spaces where the experiments were carried out. And Tiller eventually set up another 3 laboratories in different places to do these experiments and found the same thing happening. Apparently, these the temperature varying by 4 degrees every 45 minutes or so was a circumstance that pertained whether the windows were open or closed, whether they had the air conditioning on, whether they had the heating on or not. One stage, apparently, they even installed a couple of giant fans in key parts of the laboratory and got them blowing so strongly that they were blowing paper around the place. And not even that appears to have made any difference at all. It is as if every corner of the room that was registered apparently registered the same result. Each aspect of the physical space appeared to be in some sort of rhythmic harmony. And this is something that hadn't apparently ever been observed anywhere else in any of the laboratories in the place where he was working, or indeed in any other laboratory. And he basically says that once enough experiments had been carried out, all of the other laboratories also began to evidence these rhythmic fluctuations. And the longer the imprinted devices were in the room, the larger the fluctuations of temperature and pH became. Somehow, his laboratory was beginning to manifest different material properties, almost as if it were a specially charged environment. Now, I think that that is a really fascinating and stunning piece of experimental work. It caught the guys that were doing the work completely by surprise for a start off. It wasn't what they were aiming to find out. It was simply something that arose as a result of them working with fruit flies and water. But to realize that you can get some kind of coherent, rhythmic, harmonious, resonant, to use a word we were using earlier, resonant response from an entire environment as a result, apparently, of intention that has been put into a little black electronic box, which is then placed in the laboratory, I find is absolutely astonishing. And it does have to be said that after years of not only reading about these kind of experiments, but actually in a way by taking on the health modalities that I have, by actually experiencing them, some of the more bizarre effects myself, they do seem to be, to me at least, it's becoming more certain that these aspects of life, the energetic part of ourselves, the part of ourselves which operates both within and around the physical, appears to me to be absolutely critical to where we are now in terms of the incoherence and the lemming-like propensities apparently of mankind. So not only where we are, but where potentially we're going. I don't see any reason why thinking about the problem on a completely different level from the level on which it's manifesting, I don't really see why, at least in theory, at some stage when we reach what we might call a tipping point, why the whole situation just shouldn't suddenly change. You know, it just seems to me that things are nothing like as fixed as we have been led to believe. And every single little bit of work that we can do on ourselves that improves our communications, that improves our own coherence, little bit of chat in the chat box there from Bob earlier on about operating from the heart space. It seems to me that by thinking with our hearts rather than our brains, and certainly by thinking with our hearts rather than our wallets, we manifest different realities around ourselves, and that affects every single entity and individual and thing that's around us. Everything is affected by these changes, and so it makes little changes in them as well. So this is important work, folks, I think. The power of manifestation, the power of intent, the desire to resonate with one's environment rather than against it, and the desire to operate from the heart and to pay attention to our gut instincts. It is realized that reason and logic are absolutely vital in a world where we are being hoodwinked day after day. But sometimes only the heart and the stomach will do. I'm still trying to find out whether No Holds Barred are coming on after the show tonight. I don't think we've heard anything as yet, so anybody's guess on that one. I'll just have another look in here, see if there's anything in this one. Right, so we don't really know. We've got some more minutes left, so I'm going to play a bit more music, come back to you one more time before the end of the show. You are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. If you're going to be anywhere on the internet, be at People's Internet Radio. And if you're listening outside, why not come and join us in the chat box? There's always really cracking stuff going on in there.